This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Hi, I'm Francesca, and I'm here with Matt, and this is this month's Ask an Astronomer. So the first question is from Henning Vester Jorgensen from Denmark, and he says, I am always a little confused about the mass momentum thing regarding photons. I'm thinking of the observations confirming Einstein's theory. Did Newtonian theory predict the light would not bend at all? I mean, the photons have a mass equivalent, right? Or did Newtonian theory just predict it bent less than the relativistic prediction?
So that's a very good question. So the mass that you described is not the mass in our usual understanding, such as I have a mass of X kilograms, the Earth has mass of Y kilograms, and so on. This sort of mass is called the rest mass, and any object with a non-zero rest mass cannot travel at the speed of light, as that would require an infinite amount of energy. The mass of photon we talk about in the framework of special relativity is a relativistic mass, and it is indeed proportional to the photon's momentum. To answer to your question, we, however, don't have to use any special relativity or general relativity and can only limit ourselves to simple reasoning used in Newtonian dynamics. So the most important answer is that Newtonian dynamics did indeed predict that the light would bend in the presence of mass. Newton himself posted this question in the last volume of his book Optics. It reads, do not bodies act upon light at the distance and by their action bend its rays? And it's not this action strongest at the least distance. So from this question, we can already see that Newton was quite seriously considering this problem. At that time, we are fairly confident that Newton treated light rays as entities composed of very small objects emitted by stars and anything that really shines. Objects that we may today call photons, so he wasn't really bothered about what we call today the wave-particle duality. At that time, they were only considering light rays as packets of some small objects. He knew that the acceleration of the body in the presence of gravitational force does not depend on the mass of the accelerated body. Well, we all remember the feather and hammer experiment performed on the surface of the moon by the crew of Apollo 15 mission. That was known in the time of Newton as well, that whatever you drop in the presence of gravitational field, its acceleration will not depend on its mass. So, you know, there was really nothing stopping massless objects from accelerating as well. If acceleration does not depend on the mass of the objects, why wouldn't massless objects accelerate? Newton, however, never really answered this question himself in any of his publications. So really, he just posted this question, but we don't have any evidence that he really, really tried to answer it. Work published by Johann Soldner at the beginning of the 19th century is one of the first, if not the first, works that tried to calculate the full solution to this problem. So as you can see, the question and the solution of whether the path of light can be bent by massive objects predates Einstein's general theory of relativity and its concepts of space-time by more than 100 years. The amount by which the light would bend if Newtonian theory of gravity was correct on large scales was found to be half of the value predicted by Einstein's GTR. It is not quite common to hear that the 1919 expedition led Sir Arthur Eddington to observe and record any changes in positions of stars during solar eclipse was able to confirm the validity of GTR because they have detected that the trajectory of light was bent by the mass of sun. In reality, what Eddington was looking for was whether the angle of deflection was consistent with Newton's or Einstein's theories of gravity. He was able to confirm, not without many problems and facing massive oppositions from the supporters of the Newtonian gravity, that the angle that the rays of light went bent at was consistent with Einstein's, not Newtonian gravity. And that provided, as we know, pretty much a first successful confirmation of the new theory of gravity. For those of our listeners interested in a more rigorous derivation, the full solution to this problem can be found in a short 2009 paper, Newtonian Gravitational Deflection of Light Revisited.
Thank you. Thanks. Moving on to the next question. This is from Ben Dyer. And they ask, I read the speed of light is different in different media, air, water, etc., and only has the speed c in a complete vacuum. First of all, is this the case, and what are some good examples? Secondly, does the speed of light therefore slow in diffuse gas clouds in the galaxy / universe, and does this effect build to a point where it affects the age of the light reaching us in any meaningful way? Thirdly, would this slowing, if it happens, affect redshift?
So when we really talk about light waves, or indeed any waves, we usually talk about two velocities, group velocity and phase velocity. Group velocity is the velocity at which the general envelope of the multi-frequency wave moves through the space. And in most real-life scenarios, it can be considered as the velocity at which the information is carried through the medium. Phase velocity, on the other hand, is the velocity of the individual waves inside the envelope. So let's start with the phase velocity, because it's mostly common to what we see on Earth. It can be defined as the speed of light divided by the refractive index. So refractive index is an intrinsic property of the material which describes how fast light travels in a given medium and how much light bends when it enters or exits this medium. In dielectric materials, the refractive index is a function of frequency, and generally it increases as the frequency of light increases. So we can see that for light at different frequencies, the refractive index will change, and therefore the speed already at which the different frequency components of light, of visible light, they will travel at different velocities. And I think that the best and arguably one of the most beautiful examples of this to demonstrate the dependence of phase velocity on the frequency is simply prism. What we see as white light is in fact composed of a whole spectrum of different colors, between blue and purple at the highest frequency part of the spectrum and red at the lowest one. The refractive index, as I said before, will therefore be different for different components, even if only slightly, and the rate of white light will be split at each of the components, would take a slightly different path due to different refractive indices, with the blue-purple colors that have the lowest velocity bend more than the orange and red traveling a bit faster. If we consider a monochromatic light wave, it is light at a single wavelength. The refraction of light itself is already a manifestation of the fact that the light travels at different speeds in different media. The situation changes when we start talking not about dielectric materials, but deionized interstellar medium, something that we astronomers are interested in. In this case, we do consider group velocity, really, because this, as I said, is information that is arriving to us. This is the information that we're recording. The group velocity in an ionized dispersive medium will always be lower than the speed of light for waves with a frequency greater than the plasma frequency, which for the interstellar medium is close to 1.4 kHz. Theoretically, it is impossible to travel for waves that have frequency lower than the plasma frequency, so whatever we really can observe has to be higher than the plasma frequency and will be traveling at the speed lower than the speed of light. And what is more important is, again, that the speed of light depends, again, on the frequency, this time due to presence of free-floating electrons in the ionized medium. It means that unless you are in the perfect vacuum, and by vacuum I mean absolutely nothing, and even the vacuum that we describe in space does not feel this requirement, as I will explain later, the speed of light will be different for different frequencies. The electromagnetic waves at higher frequencies will be slowed down less than those at lower frequencies. The energy of the photon is proportional to its frequency, so you can imagine that photons at higher frequencies will have more energy to push through matter that is trying to stop them. Similarly to when you run through the crowded shopping center, it is easier to push people out of your way than when you walk slowly. And please don't do this, and I do not advise running through the crowded shopping center, and do not take any responsibility for any possible injuries or problems with law that it may cause. This property of light can cause some interesting effects in some of the data we record. I personally work with pulsars and fast radio bursts, and one of the ways we can measure the distance to these objects is through the so-called dispersion measure. As the name can suggest, it has a lot in common with the dispersion in water droplets or in prism that I have talked about. Even though we talk about vacuum in space, this vacuum doesn't really mean a perfect nothingness or emptiness. We can still find atoms and subatomic particles floating in space. They are present at very small densities, and on average you can find about one atom of hydrogen per cubic centimeter. But the density in different regions of our galaxy can differ by a few orders of magnitude, depending on whether you are in the less dense outskirts of the galaxy, or more crowded spiral arms, or the densest galactic center. But even at such small densities, the light can interact with the matter between stars and galaxies and produce visible effects, the dispersion measure being one of them. When we record the signal coming from a pulsar using a radio telescope, such as our very own Lovell telescope at the Jodrell Bank Observatory, we do it over a finite bandwidth, usually a multiple of megahertz. What we see is that every pulse from the pulsar arrives first at the highest frequency part of the spectrum, with lower frequencies arriving later. This effect has a quadratic dependence on frequency, so you can expect that a signal emitted at 1 GHz will have a dispersion delay 4 times greater than the signal travelling at 2 GHz. The difference in arrival times between the highest and lowest frequencies in our measured band depends on the center frequency at which you observe, the bandwidth you use, and the amount of stuff between you and the object you observe, and it can be anywhere between a fraction of a second up to tens of seconds for lowest observing frequencies and largest distances. The effect of dispersion broadens the recorded pulse and reduces signal-to-noise ratio, and therefore has to be removed in a rather computationally expensive process using complicated, carefully tuned computer algorithms. But pulsar dispersion is not all bad. By measuring the dispersion of the pulsar, we effectively measure the amount of matter the radiation interacts with as it travels towards our telescope. If we have an independent estimate of the distance to the pulsar obtained through, for example, parallax measurements, we can then measure the electron density along the line of sight, which can tell us more about the composition of our Milky Way. The situation gets even more complicated when we move further away from our galaxy, so far that we have to take cosmological effects such as the expansion of the universe that you have mentioned in your question into account. That makes everything more complicated, but to be honest, as pulsar astronomers, we did not have to be concerned about this problem, as the vast majority of the objects we observe in the radio part of the spectrum are within our Milky Way, where we don't have to worry too much about the expansion of the universe. It all changed, however, in 2007 with the discovery of the first fast radio bursts. We now believe that these are events that take place at cosmological distances, with redshifts usually greater than a half, where the effects of the expansion of the universe have to be taken into account because they are important for our equations. As the universe expands, the wavelength of the signal emitted from the object increases and its frequency decreases. That makes the frequency of the recorded signal a function of distance to the object, and we have to be really careful when using it with our usual dispersion measure calculations. We have to include not only the amount of matter into the galactic medium that we know much less about than about interstellar medium, but also the correct cosmological models that depend on the curvature and the composition of the universe if we really want to get a correct distance to these objects. So things get much more complicated the further you go away from us.
And finally this week, Tom Perry asks, how does the concept of year figure into light-year measurements? A year seems so Earth-centric that it's hard for me to understand how light is measured by a year.
So, a question like that comes up fairly often in one form and another, mainly because a year is rather confusingly used for measuring distance. So first, let's quote a definition by International Astronomical Union, which says that a light year is equal to the distance travelled by light in one Julian year in a vacuum, as measured here on Earth. And by Julian year, we mean 365 and a quarter of a day. So in a sense, yes, it's a fairly Earth-centric as we use our Earth year. It is, however, very convenient to use. We use it because it makes expressing vast distances in the universe much easier. It is easier to say that Proxima Centauri is 4.25 light years away from the Earth, rather than saying it's at the distance of more than 4×10⁻⁶ meters, or 40 trillion kilometers. That would make writing papers and books pretty horrible. If needed, it can be still expressed in meters and used in equations that rely on SI unit, but it's much more practical to use it when comparing the distances to an object. It can also help us talk about the travel times between objects in the universe. If I say that TRAPPIST-1 is at the distance of around 40 light years from the Earth, you know that it would take us 40 years to get there when traveling at the speed of light, which is impossible. 8 years at half the speed of light, etc. But if I told you the distance was 38×10⁻⁰ kilometers, I personally would have no idea whether that's very far or very, very far. So again, in this sense, light year is just a very convenient way of putting very large distances into easily manageable numbers. And it's very useful because it really has a very simple definition. A light year is also not the only Earth-centric unit of measure of distance. The other one, in my opinion, is the astronomical unit, which is more or less defined as a mean distance between the Sun and the Earth. When our solar system is concerned, defining one AU as close to 150 million kilometers and using it for measuring distances between objects in our system makes sense. One light year is equal to little bit more than 63,241 AU, so at larger distances it simply makes sense to talk about light years rather than millions of astronomical units. And as you have said, these are very Earth-centering and not universal, so if we were to meet a civilization living on a planet much closer to the host star with a much shorter period, their definition of light year and astronomical unit, if they actually had any, would be totally different. But let's be honest, in this case, even our choice of meter would be pretty much arbitrary.